and again, and fighting up and down their narrow street using the wooden sword someone's grandfather had made, playing knights and pirates and whatever else their imaginations could devise. And apparently, someone had given them some instruction, because the bear's stance wasn't half bad, Mircha thought, and then shook his head because he was clearly losing his mind. Only if he was, so was the rest of the garden. Everyone was in flux, yelling, laughing, squealing and pointing, or pulling back out of the way of the chase, which was quickly moving around the confined space, or jostling for position with all the newcomers flooding in to see what the fuss was about. Everyone, that is, except for Mircha, who knew he should do something but had no idea what. For a moment, he just stood there, hugging the wall and staring like everyone else, both because the spectacle deserved it, and because, while he wasn't sure what to do, he knew instinctively what not to do. He must not give any indication that he had any special knowledge of what was happening. The farce of a man being chased about by his own pet, which was now spanking him with the flat of the sword every few steps or so, might look amusing, but that could quickly change. Very quickly. Mircha had recently brokered an agreement with the Vampire Senate for his Domphir daughter, whom they would normally have killed on sight, to remain unharmed, as long as she stayed under his care and in Venice. Even then, the agreement was good only until she grew up, but at least it gave her a modicum of safety, a modicum that would last exactly as long as her mental abilities remained unknown. For his kind respected power above all things, as long as it was theirs. But power they didn't have and couldn't counter in the hands of a despised Domphir? Dorina would be dead the moment they knew. Dorina, Mircha thought softly, careful not to raise even his mental voice, because many of the vampires here tonight were senior enough that they might pick up on a stray thought, as he had done.
That is sufficient. Go home now.
He'll hurt the bear some more if I do.
I don't think he's going to be hurting anything tonight, darling,
Mircha thought, which was an understatement. The mage was hysterical, staring around between blows, yelling the names of other mages whom he seemed to believe were pranking him, and then tripping over something, Mircha didn't see what, and huddling in a little ball, arms over his head, whimpering every time a sword smack landed.
"Can you get home alone?"
Mircha asked. Surreally, the bear looked his way and nodded. He swallowed.
"Go, then."
And she did, because Dorina was always obedient, although one had to remember to state exactly what was required. Otherwise, she had an impressive ability to find ways around even some of his most carefully worded instructions. Like that one, he thought, as the sword was discarded, flung away into some bushes. In favor of the whip.
No, no,
Mircha thought, but it was too late. Because the whip, which had been sizzling against the ground like a snake made out of lightning, was even easier to use than the sword. The bear scooped the non-burning handle into its mouth and turned toward the doors to the main part of the house, which were open again thanks to everyone coming this way. Everyone who suddenly found themselves facing a huge, angry, fire-wielding bear. Things went about the way one would expect after that, with Mircha being all but trampled as a house full of finely dressed people screamed and fought and stepped on one another in their panic to get away. By the time he made it back to his feet and into the house, it was to see overturned tables, shattered vases, burning draperies, and a long, blackened, still-smoking line on walls and floors and furniture, showing where the bear had been. He ran to the front door, just in time to see a fiery whip flaring in the distance, appearing to levitate down the bank of a canal, because the dark hulk that carried it, and that his soft-hearted daughter was not about to leave behind, was no longer visible against the night. Mircha sagged back against the wet bricks of the palazzo, feeling dizzy, and watching two finely dressed guards crawl out of the canal cursing, and wondered, not for the first time, If he was up to this... Parenting, he had discovered, was harder than he'd thought. Chapter 15. I awoke to rain seeping in the side of my tent and a crick in my neck. I poked my head out of a flap to see deep blue darkness spread over the lawn for a blanket, fey tents glowing faintly in the gloom, and somebody moving around in the kitchen. Well, okay, I technically heard the latter, not being able to see them from here, and because they were cursing softly. My stomach growled. It seemed that half of a large swan hadn't been enough to satisfy it, and I knew the drill. It was either stay here and stare at the top of my tent because I wasn't going back to sleep, or get up and do something about it. I unfolded myself, cracked my neck, and padded into the kitchen, and found one of the royal guards staring at the coffee pot in annoyance. I grinned, and not just because the Fae loved coffee, although they refused to admit it, since that would also require admitting that something about the human world was superior to their own, but because they refused to understand how electricity worked. I plugged in the pot, and it started gurgling and burping its way toward heating some water. "Thank you," the Fae told me, looking slightly abashed. "I always forget to do that." "No problem." Coffee sounded pretty good. My body was all wonky from sleeping much of the day. I could use a pick-me-up. Of course, I could use some food, too. I mentally started running down the list of takeaway places open at 1 a.m. that might still be willing to deliver to us, when a package of something appeared under my nose.
"I don't know that humans will like them," the Fae said, a little awkwardly. "But they go well with coffee."
They turned out to be hard little wafer things, which could have passed for biscotti if I hadn't been given them by a glowing blonde god with a basketball star's height. I tried one. They did, as it turned out, go well with coffee. The Fae and I sat at the kitchen table, chowing down. He wasn't one I'd had any contact with, and he looked young. Not that they all didn't. I'd yet to see a wrinkle or an age spot even on Cademan, who looked maybe 30 on a rough day. This one didn't look much younger, maybe 20 or so, but he felt younger. The easy assurance with which Cademan did everything, as if he were an actor on the final take after days of rehearsal, was totally missing here. This one had not only forgotten to plug in the coffee pot, he'd also been standing in the dark until I'd switched on the light, which had made him jump, and seemed fascinated by the self-sealing coffee bag with its little zipper closure, and was now examining the condiments in the center of the table, delicately sniffing the Tabasco sauce before rearing back in alarm, and blinking at it worriedly. "We don't usually put that in coffee," I told him, and he nodded, setting it back in place. I got up and rummaged through the cabinets, which were pretty much back to normal. There were a few oak sprigs pointing out here and there, but nothing that interfered with functionality, and the apple tree was completely gone, a pale scar cut across the ceiling boards, some of which were still out of alignment. But other than that, you'd think it had never existed. Even the old ship's lantern was back in place and shining smugly, because I guess it had won. Okay, it had definitely won, I thought, noticing a discreet pile of apple logs stacked by the stove. That was a little disturbing, but not surprising. This house had had issues long before the Fae showed up. The big old Victorian had been built a century ago, right smack on top of a vortex. Yes, one of those vortexes, the wells of power created when two or more ley lines cross. And yes, those ley lines, the rivers of magical energy that flow across our world and then beyond, serving some purpose in the grand scheme of things that nobody had quite figured out yet. Some people think that they're the result of two universes rubbing together, ours and the one Fairy resides in, like great tectonic plates, with energy bubbling up like lava along the fault lines. Others believe that the planets act as giant talismans, collecting the magical energy of creation and distilling it into rivers of current, which they then send rocketing across metaphysical space. Still others believe that the Earth itself generates them as a kind of byproduct, like gravity or lightning, just one that's not detectable to non-magical humans. There were 1,000 theories, and no one knew which, if any, were right. But that didn't stop people from sussing out vortexes and building structures on top of them to benefit from all that free energy. Of course, the main whirlpools of power, those that weren't too strong to use, had been claimed centuries ago. But not all were so obvious. Some vortexes had formed on cadet branches of the lines, little ones that didn't go anywhere interesting, and thus didn't get much traffic. Or that weren't well explored, because the ley line system hadn't been known about for all that long, magically speaking. And then there were those that formed in a field of vortexes, such as the one that lay all over New York City, allowing them to hide in the glow and remain undetected. At least, long enough for someone to plop a house down on them. That someone, a retired ship's captain, hadn't known what he'd had, but Claire's Uncle Pip did, and snapped it up as soon as the old boy died, and started layering his treasure with protection spells, which in themselves hadn't been a problem. The trouble came when he decided to link said spells, not to his own power or to a talisman, the magical equivalent of a battery, but directly into the vortex itself. And then to just leave them there to do their own thing for decades. That had caused some problems, because spells aren't meant to last forever. They peter out if not renewed, or expire with the death of the caster, which is actually a good thing, because it prevents them from becoming weird. Unattended magic can become problematic over time, as the rules of the original spell become confused, or get overwritten by pieces they borrow from other spells around them, or link up with the wild magic of the earth. The upshot was that the house had become a little eccentric over the years, almost like it had a mind of its own, or a personality, anyway. Specifically, that of a crotchety old woman who didn't like people messing with her stuff. Really didn't, I thought, glancing at the hall, where a bunch of small things were writhing helplessly under sheets of faded floral wallpaper, which had previously been shredded by burgeoning pecan pods, and which were now whole again and set on revenge. Watching them cause the same kind of creeping horror as watching a sweet old lady in a lilac-covered housecoat slowly strangling a small animal to death, until I quickly looked away and continued to rummage. Hey, I had to sleep upstairs, okay? If the house wanted to murder some pecans, that was its business. A moment later, I'd gathered everything up and set a line of creamers in front of the fay. There was everything from peppermint mocha to caramel macchiato, because Claire is a flavored coffee nut. He just stared at them, apparently overwhelmed by the choice. I pointed at the coconut creme. That one's good, and the amaretto. I'd stay away from the butter pecan. I glanced at the hall, at least right now. The Fae eyed the little bottle warily, as if I'd told him it was poisoned, and opted for the coconut. "That's nice," he said, looking up at me in surprise. I nodded. "Claire really likes that one. I use her for my barometer on all things Fae." "Your gauge, measure, test?" I guess they didn't have barometers in Fairy. He nodded. "Thank you. I'm supposed to be improving my English, but there are many words I don't know." "That's why you're here? Other than to guard her, I mean."
"I don't think she needs much guarding,"
he blurted out, and then looked mortified when he realized what he had said.
I mean...
"I know what you mean."
No, you...
He stopped, realizing that he was halfway off his stool. and with a hand reached out as if to touch me reassuringly, which he quickly drew back, because the Fae are famously lacking in the whole touchy-feely department. Well, except for Cademan. But he was a rule unto himself on a lot of things.
"I'm sorry."
The young Fae sat back down.
"I'm also supposed to be working on my ability to speak as though I had thought about it beforehand."
He sounded like he was quoting. "Cademan told you that?" He shook his head.
"My father. He is one of the king's chief counselors, but I just say things. I don't mean offense, but..."
"But people take it that way." A miserable nod. He had a longer-than-usual neck, even for a fae, and was drinking coffee while we spoke. He was starting to remind me of those mechanical drinking birds. Nod, sip. Nod, sip. It was kind of hypnotizing. "Don't worry, I do the same thing," I said. "Only I usually intend to piss people off." The kid just sat there, clutching the coffee cup in his hands and looking unsure of himself, as if he was trying to parse both the language and the humor and was having a problem with it. He didn't seem to multitask well. "Or maybe it's your humor, Dory," I thought wryly. "Stop teasing the infant." But he recovered pretty fast.
"I just meant that she's so powerful. And she has you. And the Jotnar. She is well guarded."
"Then why are you here?" Again a pause.
"Me or everyone?"
"Both. Either. I didn't really care that much, but I was enjoying the cookies."
"Well, we're here, the group of us, I mean, as, I suppose you would call it, an honor guard?"
I nodded, since he seemed to like that gesture.
"And because, well, you're not powerful just by having power. You must know how to wield it. And the king says..."
"Claire doesn't know how yet." He nodded, looking relieved. Maybe because I'd said it, so he didn't have to.
"And you?"
The Fae didn't answer. His eyes were on Gessa, who had just come in, her curly brown hair even messier than usual, a yawn threatening to split her face. She dragged a stool over to the counter, climbed up on top to pour herself some coffee, then plopped her butt down on the all-purpose piece of furniture to drink it.
"Gessa, do you know..."
I looked at the Fae, who was looking at the little nursemaid with an expression somewhere between curious and concerned, like a sleepy 3-foot-tall au pair was a potential threat. Gessa yawned again.
"You have a name?"
I asked the Fae, more pointedly.
"What?"
He blinked at me, and then blushed when he realized he'd been staring. Not that Gessa seemed to care. She was staring now, too. At his cookies.
Yes. Hemming," he said,
watching her scoot her stool over the floor and brazenly take half his stash.
"But, they don't call me that."
"What do they call you?" I was familiar by now with the fact that the Fae had about 50 names each, but for some reason this request only made him blush harder.
"So Winnie,"
he finally said, like he was admitting something. Gessa snorted into her coffee. "What's funny?" I asked her, but she just shook her head.
"It means boy,"
the Fae blurted out.
"I'm not as old as the others."
"No shit," I didn't say, because despite what certain people believe, I do have manners. Sometimes. "So what are you doing here?" I asked instead. "Or do they regularly take boys on trips like this?"
"I'm not actually a boy,"
the boy hastened to assure me.
"I just haven't really gone anywhere before, and my father thought..."
"Earth would be a good starter trip?" He nodded some more, but this time he was more animated.
"I'm glad he did. It's so interesting here. Home is beautiful, but nothing ever happens. I've only been here a short time, yet there's been so much, well, happening.
We like to stay busy. Gessa rolled her eyes. I kicked her under the table. She stole my last cookie in retaliation, and I still had coffee left. I sipped it resentfully, and so Winnie looked back and forth between the two of us, apparently confused. "So you're doing the tourist thing?" I asked, and got more confusion in return. "You're here to explore, maybe take some pictures?" I rephrased.
Well, my father does want me to get more experience, but so far, the others haven't let me out of the yard.
Gessa opened her mouth. I kicked her again. She grinned unrepentantly and chewed at me.
But it's mostly that I have a sort of talent.
A talent?
Yes, a rare gift among my people, he said,
looking confident for the first time.
At least it is these days. They say there used to be more of us, but some skills have diminished. But it's thought to be really useful.
Useful how? What do you do?
It's difficult to explain. It's usually described as a kind of far-seeing, but that's not really very accurate. I mean, we do see far, but...
So you're a clairvoyant?
What? Oh, no, no.
Because Gessa here reads runes, don't you, Gessa? She shook her head at me, her mouth full of stolen cookie. What do you mean, no? You read mine a week ago. She swallowed.
Stinky take.
Take what? The stones? She nodded. He didn't eat them, did he?
No, not eat.
She thought about it for a moment.
Probably.
I sighed. With Stinky, that was the best assurance anyone could give. Then what did he do with them? Gessa ate the last bite and hopped off her stool.
Come.
I'd finished my coffee and all the cookies were gone, so I followed her out of the kitchen and across the hall into the living room we rarely used because the garden was roomier and less full of dusty old furniture that never got any less dusty because of one of those spells Claire's uncle had put in place. It was supposed to be a housekeeping spell, which would have been great, except that it didn't exactly clean things. It just kept them the way they'd been when it was first laid, and Claire's uncle had apparently had an inability to see dirt, or dust at least. So the spell would clean up a dropped soda, for instance, if you left it there long enough, but afterward the old boards would still have as much dust on them as before. It infuriated Claire, who was a bit of a neatnik, but the house didn't care. The spell had taught it to see the vaguely tidy but sort of old and dusty interior as the perfect version of the world, and by God, it was going to stay that way. Forever. Gessa, however, didn't seem to mind the dust, or the ugly furniture, or the fussy drapes, and of course the boys only cared that the TV worked. As a result, the living room had become a playroom that was more toy-strewn by the day, including the large cardboard box in the corner that Gessa was now peering inside of, and swearing loudly. "What is it?" I asked, hurrying over. The sides of the box had been decorated with taped-on pieces of paper with bright blue skies, fluffy white clouds, and rich green hills scribbled on them, and at the bottom was a chessboard that had been a gift from Olga and had become the boy's favorite toy, although not because either of them was interested in strategy. They just liked to watch the fights. And since this was a troll board, that's exactly what they got. One side was made up of angry little ogres, and the other of tiny pissed-off trolls, which had been enchanted to be pretty darn lifelike. The board was enchanted, too, to ensure that the two groups didn't see a cardboard cell, but rather a large, rolling world in miniature, full of open fields, shaded grottos, and velvety forests, a world they would battle to the death to defend, or at least to the end of the game. Only lately that time never came, because the boys never put their toys away, So instead of chess, we'd ended up with a social experiment, in which both sides spent less time battling and more time building villages, hunting for food in the tall grass, and fishing in the little streams. The last time I'd looked in, they'd managed to construct some rudimentary huts out of the grass, only I guess that hadn't been good enough for Stinky, who had donated Gessa's runes for building materials. The trolls had piled them up into what looked like a cave formation, while the ogres were constructing actual tiny houses. Or they had been. But I didn't see anybody moving around right now. That was strange. There was usually somebody carrying in game, punching up one of the tiny fires or scratching his miniature ass. And then, belatedly, I saw what Gessa had, which probably explained why she was crawling around on the floor still cussing. A bunch of fern on a table above the box had all but exploded out of its pot, thanks to Cademan's overflowing magic. Which would have been fine, except that a single frond had dipped into the box, like a piece of Yggdrasil, the mythological world tree, fallen to earth, and had changed everything. Because while we'd been dealing with the drama of our day, the little chess pieces had been having some of their own. To us, it was just a piece of fern, but to them, it was a ladder, a stairway to heaven, because it gave them a way out of the game, and into a house that didn't like competing magic and already had a serious snit on. "Is something wrong?" Sowinnie asked, looking from me to Gessa. "Probably not," I said, trying not to think about the two cats lounging on the sofa, watching us uninterestedly, which weren't really cats. They were yet more wards, created by Claire's uncle because he'd been running an illegal still in the basement that he hadn't wanted anybody to find. And nobody had, partially because the cats could suddenly expand to the size of prehistoric saber-toothed fluffiness and freaking end you. "Shit," I told Gessa, who nodded.
"Must find."
Yeah, before the house enacted who knew what kind of revenge. "Spread out," I told the troops. They quickly did so, Gessa taking one side of the room and throwing pillows off couches, and Sowinnie lighting up the other, and gingerly swishing aside drapes. I took the hall with the murderous wallpaper, in case any of the little pieces had made it this far. And sure enough, I spied a tiny guy all the way at the end of the hall near the front door, making a run for it. Only, weirdly enough, he appeared to be running this way. "Gessa, do we have a box or something?" I asked, wondering if the little thing had gotten into some paint somewhere because he looked kind of red. And then the whole room did, when a giant fist came out of nowhere and sent me flying. Chapter 16. The blow felt like a sledgehammer backed by a semi. I hit the stairs hard enough to stun me, hard enough that my nerves started blaring all kinds of warnings from virtually everywhere, hard enough that I looked up and found myself already in ultra-slow-mo, the way movies are filmed when the shit has most definitely hit the fan. It works the same way for vampires, when their brains realize they're in over their heads. Time, of course, doesn't actually slow down, but their perception of it does, giving them what feels like a few added seconds to evaluate a situation. It's one reason they're so deadly, and why they move like quicksilver in battle, their every move looking precise, calculated, and well thought out, because it usually is. That state had always been a rarity for me, and only in extremis. Probably wasn't a good thing that my brain already thought I needed it, huh? Or the fact that it didn't seem to be working right. The hallway was fine, having taken on the familiar underwater feel of slow-mo. I saw Gessa through the door to the living room, looking up in concern, her brown curls bouncing slowly around her head. I saw a piece of the railing I'd hit on my way to destroy my rib cage flipping leisurely through the air. I saw little siftings of dust raining gently down from where the force of my impact had shaken them loose from the ceiling. Everything was exactly as I'd have expected. except for the fist slamming into the stairs right by my head, still fast, still deadly, and still looking like it was in real time, to the point that I barely managed to dodge it. Which meant that whatever was assaulting me was fast, very fast, faster than me, I thought dizzily, trying to assess the situation while scrambling backward up the stairs, and attempting to avoid a second blow while still reeling from the first. That wasn't working so great, and wouldn't have worked at all except for the house, because the latest massive hole that the Hulk-like fist had left in the stairs had just closed up around it, like a wooden maw clamping down, and clamping hard. That left me half a second to focus my bleary eyes on my attacker, only that didn't help much, because I'd never seen anything like it. It was roughly the size and shape of a large troll, only it wasn't one. Not unless there was some kind I didn't know about, made out of lava right before it hardens with a cracked reddish crust on top and fiery-looking stuff inside, which would have been worth a double take or maybe two, but I didn't have time, because the damned thing had two fists, didn't it? The second crashed into the wall beside me, because I dodged at the last second, sending shards of hardwood into the skin of my cheek and neck. I stumbled backward, halfway up the stairs now, and still dizzy, because it had been all of a couple seconds since this whole thing started, and because we had wards, damn it, about 1,000 of the things, many of which weren't legal anymore, if they'd ever been, and all of them on steroids from sucking on an energy teat for much of the last century. So how did the damned thing get in? Make that damned things, I thought, looking past the huge, thrashing, rock-like beast, which now had both fists trapped by a pissed-off house, and saw its backup, like it needed any, spiraling up from the floor. That's the best way I can describe it, although it doesn't do it justice. More of the small things I'd mistaken for toys were running at me, a whole line of them from the direction of the door, and getting bigger and meaner with every step. And more like Pigpen, because it looked like all the dust in the house, even that sifting down from the ceiling, was curving, was flowing out, was joining up with the rock-hard bodies they were forming like little stair-steps, and forming them fast. They were cleaning the house for maybe the first time ever, which unfortunately I wasn't going to live to see because I couldn't take this many. But something else could. Suddenly, out of every room along the hallway, the kitchen, the dining room, the guest bath, even the living room, prompting a startled eep from Gessa, came the cavalry. I was busy trying to get back to my feet while a roaring rock monster thrashed in my face, and my ankle, which had gotten injured along with everything else, kept trying to give way on me. So for a second I didn't understand what I was seeing. And then I did, and I still didn't believe it. Because the huge bodies suddenly flinging themselves at our attackers looked a lot like the missing chess pieces. They had the same mottled brown or dirty green skin tones. They had the same patched leather armor and dull iron and steel weapons. They had the same little tusks on the ogres and the same beady little eyes on the trolls, although little really didn't work as a descriptor anymore, because they were huge. For a moment, I thought I must have hit my head too hard, but then I saw it. Or rather, I saw him, a troll different from all the rest, darker of color and wilder of eye, because he'd seen some shit in his short life. And I'm afraid I mean that literally. Because Stinky, who eats everything that doesn't try to eat him first, had accidentally swallowed him along with some animated circus cookies that Olga had brought over from a troll bakery. They'd been galloping and neighing and generally stampeding around the kitchen table, and Stinky, never one to miss an opportunity, had opened his mouth and let them just fall in. Only something else had fallen in as well and gone for the ride of its life. We had managed to retrieve the little troll after his journey, but he'd never been quite the same again, including his hardened leather battle gear, which was sadly acid-eaten, and useless by the time he, popped up. So Stinky, who had been made to understand that you don't eat little sort of sentient creatures even if they only got that way because of a spell, had made him a new set. Which was why one of the suddenly massive former chess pieces was wearing soda can armor. Only the house, which I guessed was what was doing this, had fiddled with that too. The familiar red background and white curly letters of one can were now a thick, molded breastplate that Batman would have been proud of. The formerly flimsy red, white, and blue logo of another was a shield Captain America might have envied. And the bright blue and green pauldrons and orange and white shin guards could have been borrowed directly from Iron Man. Who I really wished would show up right about now, because we were still getting hammered. Maybe our attackers didn't feel anything. Or if they did, they gave no sign. Even when I got my shit together, grabbed a jagged piece of wood that the trapped monster was shredding as fast as the house could regrow it, and started trying my best to shove it through its eye. Only it didn't have eyes, although it could obviously see. But there was nothing inside the vague indentations in the skull but darkness and more rock. And when I did finally manage to break off a chunk, it didn't seem to care. Just kept coming at me, only now with the added horror of doing it sans a third of its face. I turned around and ran.
"What is it?"
That was Claire, pulling on a dressing gown and coming out of her room as I half ran, half limped into mine.
"You know that learning curve you've been on?"
I said, throwing open my closet door. "It's been accelerated."
"What?"
She'd come in behind me.
"Dory!"
I grabbed a duffel bag in one hand and her arm in the other.
"Get to the kids. You're the last line of defense. Anything gets past me, burn it to the ground."
I didn't wait to see if she got it or not, because in the short time I'd been away, and it had been fucking short, the lead creature had broken loose from the house and leapt up the stairs, only to be blown all the way back down into the line of backup headed this way, and with a new basketball-sized burning hole in its torso, the blackened edges still on fire when it landed, and sent the others falling into what had become a battle of epic proportions and was about to get more so, because the duffel I'd grabbed wasn't black. There was nothing in my usual stash that would work on these things. I wasn't even going to try. So I'd gone straight for the red sack of special occasion toys I rarely use, since none of them are legal and all of them would normally be massive overkill. But it always helps to be prepared, I thought, ratcheting the special shotgun again. And cutting loose. The nice thing about buying magic from dark mages, I thought, is that they just don't give a damn. There's none of the hand-wringing, permit-needing, or side-eye-giving that you get from the legit places, not to mention that the selection is, oh, rather better. Because this little baby was the definition of one shot and done. Except when used on these guys, apparently. Because while this thing would put down a charging bull elephant, or a freakishly huge rock monster, in a single shot, the latter didn't stay down. Like the first creature I'd hit, who had ended up sprawled on a pile of his buddies, but who was already getting up, was closing the wound, was coming for me, and was getting his head blown off for a chaser. But even that didn't seem to matter, to him or to the others I was busy turning into Swiss cheese, because they healed the same way they had formed, by pulling dust and dirt through the air, or through cracks in the floorboards, or from under the front door. And there was no way to stop it, because the wards, good as they were, had been designed to keep out normal threats, spells and hexes and more mundane stuff like bullets. They weren't designed for this. That thought connected to something in my brain that had been nagging at me, like maybe it was important. Only I didn't have time to worry about it right now, because I was going to run out of rounds before they ran out of dirt, which meant, okay, no more Ms. Nice Guy. Which is why the next minute or so, 30 grand's worth of next-level, badass, lethal-as-we-want-to-be magical weapons go up in smoke, and fire, and a hail of flying steel shavings that buzzed through the rock like a drill bit through wood, leaving only dust clouds behind, which immediately coalesced into more rock monsters. It quickly became apparent that, while my toys worked a wonder on flesh, nothing works on dirt. And that includes the ever-nasty, always-favorite, terribly expensive dislocator, the kind of pretty bauble that, once it explodes in your face, You no longer have a face. You have ears growing out of your knee, and a smile on your ass, and brains where your kidneys ought to be, because your entire upper body had just been dislocated to somewhere not conducive to life, hopefully, because the damage is not reversible. Unless you happen to be a freaking rock monster, in which case you just turn dusty for a second and do a little twist and writhe that hurts the brain of the person watching you because torsos aren't designed to turn into Escher-like knots. And then, hey, presto, good as new. Okay, that was fairly impressive, I decided, digging furiously around my pack for something, anything, that might work on these things. But while a bunch of auto-garrots disrupted the next charge up the steps, popping off heads that I thereafter kicked back into the fray, it was a momentary victory. Like the potion bombs that ate huge craters into the next assault, or the cloud of fighting stars that a war mage had enchanted for me, which zipped about, glittering impressively in the gloom, since most of the lights had been shattered by now, but didn't do much else but ricochet harmlessly off rock, and I was running out of options. And yet another charge was forming, or trying to, because they really wanted up these stairs, didn't they? But they were being opposed by our no longer little chess pieces, who were splitting heads and cleaving limbs much more effectively than before. They'd been having trouble at first due to their blade weapons shattering on the stone-like surface of the enemy, but they had figured out that massive fists and iron maces and huge heavy wooden shields were more effective. As a result, the hall and rooms branching off it had turned into a sea of churning rubble, spotted with flotsam in the forms of lamps and pieces of furniture and Gessa, passing by like Rose after the Titanic sank, riding a piece of door while jabbing at reforming rock monsters with a pike, and then yelling at me. I didn't know why. Until I realized a new monster had formed out of the pieces of his fallen brothers on the stairs, and had stayed low until he was whole enough to make a surge upward and grab me by the throat. There was no way I was breaking that hold, not in time and probably not at all, but there was time to make a gesture. And small though it was, it worked. Because, sure, you can save a few bucks here and there on sales of ammo or two-for-one grenades at that one guy's stand at the local gun show. But there are things you simply pay the asking price for and don't argue. Because one day they're going to save your life. Like my little stars did for me. Because all of them suddenly paused, midair, and zoomed back this way. And kamikazed the massive stone arm like a magical jackhammer. And while most of them got stuck in the rocky hide, or went ricocheting off, bent out of all usefulness, their combined force was enough to crack the forearm, allowing me to finish the job with a savage upward blow. The arm cleaved and shattered. I fell back, gasping and choking, and had the other fist come at me almost before I could blink. But this time, I'd expected it, and managed to get my legs up, including the one with the possibly broken ankle, because there was no other choice, leaving me with the giant fist in both hands, keeping it back from my face, my legs on its chest, pushing it away with everything I had, and my body shuddering in pain, because any second now, yeah, there it was. Make that a definitely broken ankle, I thought, screaming in the beast's face, because why the hell not? My duffel was just a few steps away, half buried under rubble, but I couldn't reach it. It was taking everything I could to hold the creature back, who was freakishly strong, like a couple of vamps worth, only he weighed a hell of a lot more. And that was before my ankle bent in ways a bone isn't supposed to and gave way entirely. I would have screamed again, the force of the break echoing through me, but all the air had just been forced out of my lungs. The creature slammed me back against the stairs, my one good leg shoved against my chest, my body bent almost in two, while a red, amorphous face thrust into mine. Staring into those dark pits of eyes, I suddenly remembered what had been nagging at me earlier. Because, no, I'd never seen these things before, but I had seen something like them, only that time they'd been strangely beautiful and made out of water. A monlikin was a fey construct formed from the elements. It wasn't human, it wasn't fey, it wasn't really anything except transport for the mind behind it, because the creature didn't pilot itself. There was no consciousness there, except for the Maker's looking out through its eyes and enjoying watching me die. "You first," I mouthed and spat in the thing's face. And oh yeah, there was a personality in there, wasn't there? Because the ugly thing reared back in fury to get the leverage to crush me against the stairs. But that also left me a second and a tiny bit of wiggle room. I used it to shove the great fist to the side, to twist, and to lunge for my bag, and to miss because my head was suddenly gripped from behind and slammed against the railing, repeatedly. I screamed in pain and fury that this was the way I was going to go out, to the fae version of a fucking drone. Until I noticed that while I hadn't gotten a hand on the duffel, I had gotten a foot, and yes, it was that foot, but right then I didn't care. Because in agony or not, the legs still worked, and so did my reaching arms, grabbing the bag that sent it flying through the air and slamming it against the massive chest as I screamed the word I'd paid a dark mage $5,000 for. It was worth every penny. I watched the space above me wrinkle and flatten and bend, and then turn strangely triangular, like I was suddenly looking at everything through a piece of abstract stained glass, and then the body, so large that towering over me like this it was literally all I could see, folded up like a deck of cards, and disappeared. Chapter 17. There was something wrong with my head. No, it was my ankle that hurt, a bright stabbing ache. I liked some pain in battle, it gave me an edge. But this was off-putting, nauseating. It hurt. But I couldn't concentrate on it. There was something wrong with my head. It had been hit a few times against a very unforgiving railing, and you had to give it to those old shipbuilders who had put this place together. The captain had some of the guys from the docks work on the house, and damn if they didn't know how to build a railing. Nobody was falling off this ship. Nope, nope. There might be something wrong with my head. I blinked, and there was a tree limb in front of me, as big around as my body and covered in hoary old bark, like it had been there forever, only I didn't think so, because a blast of dirt and rock came with it, like somebody had just unloaded a dump truck on me. It made me cough and gag, because I'd had my mouth open, and now on top of everything else, I could barely breathe. And then some apples fell on my head. Probably not a good thing. There was already something wrong with it. But at least the limb seemed to have taken out a couple more rock creatures, like a bark-covered fist shooting out of the kitchen, where I guess the apple logs had sprouted again and slammed into two assailants I hadn't noticed until what was basically a sideways tree smashed through the middle of them and sent a crap ton of fruit bouncing down the stairs. I just lay there, watching it go, because I couldn't do anything else. The limb was lying across me like it meant business, and anyway, my brain didn't seem to be taking orders right now. But I wasn't too concerned, and not just because of the comfortable darkness that kept trying to eat at my vision, but because of the crashes and yells and renewed clang, clang, clang of metal on stone. The Fae had arrived, lighting up the hallway as if dawn had come in a moment. I flashed on that scene with Gandalf showing up with the Rohirrim at Helm's Deep, because even half-dead, I am a huge fucking nerd. "To the king," I whispered, laughing, and then couldn't remember why. There was something wrong with my head. And this time I could name it, because it was weirdly like static, only no, static didn't hurt this much. I think I screamed. I'm not sure, since all I could hear was that awful white noise, but I felt like screaming, and rending, and tearing, and stabbing whoever was repeatedly sticking an ice pick in my fucking ear. But there was no one there. Except for Cademan, who was looking slightly weirded out. "What?" I said as the static retreated, and watched him blink at me. It seemed to take a long time, but maybe not, because then he was gone again. I heard the front doors slam open and peered over the tree limb to see everything start to get sucked out. Or blown out, because it seemed like the wind was coming from in here. I didn't know. I just knew that pieces of wood and other debris, even some of the smaller rocks, went flying and disintegrating, in the case of the latter, as they sailed through the air outside. I could see them through the transom, puffing away into nothingness above the streetlights like dirty fireworks. Big dirty fireworks, because a few of the creatures were getting blown out, too. It looked like some of the Fae had tiny whirlwinds in their hands that they were throwing at the rock monsters, but obviously not. There was something wrong with my head.
"They can't hold their form too far off the ground," Cademan yelled,
because he was back again, his long blonde hair whipping around his face. I nodded. That explained why they hadn't just formed upstairs to begin with. Good to know, I thought dizzily. And then I blacked out, because there was something wrong with my head. I woke up on the kitchen table screaming in pain.
"Be still,"
Cademan said, holding my ankle and looking harassed. Normally it would have been funny to see him with his shining fall of hair a frazzled mess, his shirt sleeves rolled up and his face red. But not when his hands were red, too, because it looked like I hadn't been the first one on the table tonight and wouldn't be the last. There were several battered and bloody Fae sitting on stools, their heads resting against walls or cabinets, as if they were too tired to hold them up. It looked like the Monlikins hadn't gone down without a fight. And then somebody else started screaming, and he sounded worse off than me.
"I said be still," Cademan snapped.
But I barely heard him because it was back again, that terrible static that sounded like a swarm of bees. Angry bees. Angry stinging bees inside my skull. Cademan appeared in my vision, grabbing the sides of my head, saying something. It looked like it might be important, and felt like he was pouring power into me, but I couldn't concentrate on anything but the bees. They were making my body jerk and strain from their constant stinging, dozens, and then hundreds of them all at once. I tried to read his lips, until my field of vision was overlaid with static too, like an old-fashioned TV on the Fritz, where sometimes you got a clear picture and other times it was just snow. "Stop it," I told myself. I'd had enough shocks for one day. I didn't need my brain deciding to break a little more for no apparent reason. Only there was a reason. I could feel it. I just didn't know what it was. And then I was screaming some more because it hurt that bad. I awoke to light and pain and noise, which wasn't unusual, and to a glowing being bending over me, holding my head between his hands, which was. I realized I was screaming and stopped, caught his shoulder and swung my legs off the side of a table before pushing him against some counters. He looked surprised, but not as much as I was. What was he? It was hard to tell. He glowed so brightly that he was difficult to see. Liquid light, white hot and yellow, outlining his body and boiled through the middle in a shimmering dance of... Gah! I didn't know. I couldn't look directly at him, not for long, and even when I did, it was useless. I'd never seen anything like him. I glanced to the side, quick flicks of the eyes, trying to see where I was, and so that he had no opportunity to break away. Not that he was trying. He was simply standing there, permitting the scrutiny, because he knew it didn't matter. I couldn't take him. The realization struck deep in my stomach, like a thudding blow. It had been a long time, a very long time, since I had felt outmatched. I could be bested by numbers or taken down by trickery, but sheer power in one being? That was rare, and even when I'd felt it, I'd never been sure of the outcome. Battle is fickle. The strongest doesn't always win. 1,000 things go into it. Strategy, patience, experience, determination. The outcome was always in question. Until now. I couldn't take him. I felt it resonate in my bones with an assurance it had never had before, felt my lips pull back from my teeth in anger and denial. What was he? Not alone, I thought, because there were others in the room, scattered about, all of them tense, unhappy, wary, and glowing softly in my mental landscape. Fay. They were wounded but on their feet with weapons out, despite the fact that one could barely hold a knife. He was shaking, imperceptible to a human, but I saw, ready to fall with barely a strike. But the others were combat-ready, despite their wounds, and still more ran through the door. These were almost untouched, with only a few cuts and bruises that showed up as dark patches in my mind, not even enough to slow them down. But it didn't matter. They weren't attacking. They were looking to the one I held for guidance, as if they weren't sure what to do. And for the first time in a long time, neither was I.
"One of my people is injured," the creature told me. "Will you let us help him?"
The request was quiet, measured, calm. The blinding energy of a moment ago was gone, drawing back inside him. He looked like a fey, I realized. He wasn't one. But he wasn't attacking either, and he'd drawn his power down. I hesitated, feeling strangely off balance. He wasn't even looking at me now, but at something behind me, near the door to the outside. Where a fey lay on the floor, I realized, arching up in pain and screaming. I didn't know why. There were no wounds of consequence on this one. He seemed to be. And then I understood, when something hit me, too, like a wave of acid. It hurt. God, it hurt. Like nothing I'd ever felt before. And that was saying something, I thought, staggering against the counter. Cademan was there, grabbing me before I hit the floor, holding on while I writhed and screamed. I wasn't usually the screaming type. I had trained myself out of it years ago because it doesn't up your chances of survival if you broadcast to the enemy both the fact that you're wounded and exactly where you are. But this time I couldn't seem to stop. And then it cut out as abruptly as it had come, leaving me panting and bent over, and then straightening up and staring wildly about, knife in hand. But all I saw were confused-looking Fay.
"Tori?"
Cademan said carefully, concern in his voice because, yeah, I was acting crazy. With good reason, I thought, still trying to spot the attacker. Because there was one. Something the Fae had missed. Something I had missed. "Someone's here," I heard myself say. And it was my voice, but lower, deadlier, almost unrecognizable. I saw a nearby guard's eye twitch. 'Cause, yeah, not bored anymore, huh? Neither was I.
"Dory."
That was Claire getting up from where she'd been kneeling by a fae. "So Winnie," I thought, recognizing the baby fae, who didn't look like he was enjoying his vacation all of a sudden. He was white-faced and panting, and looking like I felt. For a moment, we just stared at each other. And then Claire was touching my arm, and the cool feel of her power was swamping me, trying to soothe, to help. "No," I jerked back. That wasn't the kind of help I needed. I flinched, suddenly back in control, but I hadn't been for a moment. I knew that, even though it felt like no time had passed, because there was a knife in my hand and I was suddenly in a different position. It was disconcerting, confusing. I took control and kept it until the job was done. I didn't slip like that. I never slipped. My back hit the counter and I snarled, my eyes flicking around the room trying to assess the threat. But for the first time in memory, I couldn't do it. Not for all of the ones right in front of me, the ones I could see. Much less the one I couldn't. The one that was sending waves of excruciating pain that were causing my brain to malfunction, or to switch consciousnesses in a desperate attempt to ward it off, I realized. flipping between me and my twin whenever one of us became overwhelmed, which was happening every few minutes now, and I didn't even know what I was fighting.
Dory!
That was the woman called Claire, my twin's friend. She was standing nearby beside the fallen Fae.